Okay, Shavua Tov. Today in our series on introductions, so we're going to take up the introduction to Chorev, which is considered a major work by Rav Hirsch. It is interesting. Before we get into the particulars of the Hakdama, and it's certainly much different. It's a much different kind of introduction than what we've seen up to now. I remember when I first read Chorev, so when I was much younger, I was like, wow, he's like so much like the Rambam, until I realized how much he wasn't. It took just many years to get to that point. And you'll see Rav Hirsch's Sefer is a very, very interesting Sefer. I always recommend, I know the guys who come to Migdal, I always tell them that that's a Sefer they should read during the year. For some reason, it doesn't occupy the same level of importance as, something like the Mishneh Torah. But it really is a very, very important sefer. And as you'll see, as you go through the introduction, you'll get a sense of whatever of Hirsch's pet peeves, as well as his unique outlook. And I'm not going to get into the labels of whether he was modern Orthodox or, where he's positioned on the spectrum. He was definitely an innovative thinker, without question. And in many ways, Chorev both tries to capture a certain, I'd say, a certain flair of what the modern world was like at that time, while still trying to stay true to Orthodox ideals. And I think you'll see that again through as we go through his Hakdama. Okay, so let's get started. Of course, we need a little bit of background. So Rav Hirsch, 1808 to 1888. He was German through and through. He's as German as you get when it comes to a German Talmud Chacham. Originally, he was supposed to actually go into business. That's what his parents wanted him to do, but he decided to choose the rabbinate instead at a very, very young age. He actually got smicha at the age of 22. He did study for your university, so he actually has that pedigree of someone who had some involvement with the secular world. They see that like the Rav also, Rav Soloveitchik, he was in the university as well. It's a very important thing, Lubavitch Rebbe too, to show that they can be modern Orthodox because, or at least they have an appreciation of the modern world because they went to university. And I would, he's very enigmatic. Rav Hirsch is one of these kind of guys where, depending on what you're, he's a classic example of somebody where you have your conclusion of what you believe, and then you just try to jam Rav Hirsch to fit that conclusion. So everyone somehow can fly the flag of Rav Hirsch, just like everyone does by the Rav. It's another unfortunate thing about Rav Soloveitchik. Everyone seems to be a student of the Rav, and they're like on completely different ends of the spectrum, and yet somehow they can channel the Rav to meet whatever conclusion they want. I think it's the same with Rav Hirsch. But there's no question he did place himself in a very difficult position, which is somewhere between, I call it the extremes, right, of the Reform movement at that time, which is not the same thing as what it's like today, and traditional Orthodoxy. So you have this this sort of speak change that's taking place in many Jews leaving traditional Orthodoxy, and Rav Hirsch in many ways tries to respond to that, but he was definitely condemned by many in the right-wing Orthodox world. So he was really through and through right in the middle. Again, does that mean he was modern Orthodox? I'm not sure necessarily in our definition of modern Orthodox today. He certainly had an appreciation for secular literature and things of that nature. But as you'll see, I think when you see how he wrote Chorev, in many ways, he's actually very, very from. But I'm trying to be as objective as possible. Okay, what did he write? So he wrote something called 19 Letters, which really took the Jewish world by storm. It's a very it's written in a very interesting style and a letter form, which was he didn't invent, but it really is a very passionate intellectual defense of Judaism. He wrote his very famous parish in the Torah. Sometimes can be very difficult to get through. He does write in the classic German way, which is not easy. Very Kantian in that sense. He wrote a commentary on the Siddur and on Tehillim. Of course, he wrote Chorev, which we're going to discuss today, and it's other things he wrote as well, letters and things of that nature. So he definitely spent a lot of his time writing. He was definitely an accomplished writer. Okay, so before we start his Hakdama to Chorev, he wrote a letter, okay, concerning its publication, where he kind of laid out some of his objectives in writing Chorev as well. So we're going to go through that letter first before we get to the Hakdama of the Sefer. So there was like a letter introducing the Sefer. And then within the Sefer itself, a separate letter, excuse me, a separate introduction. So, So let's get started with the letter of introduction. Okay. So he says as follows. Okay. So he says, first, he's very funny. He starts off by saying that Chorev must be one volume. Okay. Although it's interesting today, the one I have is one volume. I do know that in the translations, it's sold as a multi-volume work, but the Refresh was very against that. Chorev has to be one volume work. Why? Because he says basically the Shulchan Aruch being divided up into four different Svarim has had a devastating effect on Halacha. And that's actually just as true today as it was back in the times of Hirsch. What do we mean? Well, we know there's four sections of the Shulchan Aruch. So Orach Chaim, I often say that everyone today is an Orach Chaim Jew, okay? Everyone today has their copy of Lamatet Melachos, the great book at home, or Shmir Shabbos Al-Chasa. Everyone can tell you what Borer is, what's Muksa, right? We're like, it's incredible. Lulav, Esrog, Sukkah, you name it. When it comes to Orach Chaim stuff, we are experts at Orach Chaim. Experts. Not even a question. Yoredeya, well, it depends. Some areas people know pretty well. Kashrus, okay, we're very machmer in Kashrus. Nida. I'd say when it comes to Nida, the truth is that outside of Chasim Kala classes, that's about the most people get when it comes to knowing Hilchos Nida. There's plenty of other parts of Yoredeya that people aren't aware of. But it's when you get to things like Chosh and Mishpat and Evan Ezer that basically people have very little knowledge of this stuff. Chosh and Mishpat, I mean, there's so many practical questions that come up in business halacha. That are very important practically. Okay, Evan Ezra, you can argue, Ksubos, Gerushim, these are things that aren't going to come up often. But Chosh and Mishpat, I mean, there's just so many questions that have to do with how a person's supposed to conduct themselves in business that people aren't aware of. And Rav Hirsch sensed that back then. He realized that the idea of having a four-volume Shulchan Aruch was very, very bad. The irony is that who, in a sense, really took Orach Chaim and put it up to a whole other level? The Mishnah Berurah, because the Mishnah Berurah is only written on Orach Chaim. So that just reinforces the idea that the Shulchan Aruch, being four separate volumes, ended up being a situation where only the first one became the primary focus, Yoredeya is a little secondary, and the last two, not much attention is paid to them at all, which is a real shame. So Rav Hirsch was very upset about that. So he insisted that when his Sefer gets published, it must be one volume. That's actually the first thing he mentions in his letter. Okay. So he says, a Jew thinks, right, that he's perfect through the observance of Orach Chaim. Okay. Now we know in Orach Chaim really essentially deals with Ben Adam L'Makom, meaning what's Orach Chaim focusing on? It's focusing on the ideal way that a Jew worships God. Okay. So Tefillin and Tzitzis and Shabbos and Chagim and things of that nature, those are all things that have Ben Adam L'Makom. And we know, for instance, like, as I mentioned before, today, if you look at it, everyone in their house has Shmir Shabbos Al-Chasa, everyone in their house has some book on halachas of kashrus, right? But if I asked how many people have a book at home on employment law, the answer is not many. So it's definitely a problem. Now, Rav Hirsch does say, listen, he says, if you can't publish it as one volume, it's okay to split it into several, but ideally, he wants everyone to look at Chorev as a one-volume work. And again, in his mind, by making it one volume, a person will never go ahead and think that Section A is somehow superior to Section B. And that was one of his goals. His goals was to look at Chorev as one uniform work, even though, as you'll see, it has different parts to it. Okay? Okay, so what's the structure of Chorev? So he lays down this letter, his plan of how he wants the Sefer to look. Okay, so first he says, he's going to first state, now this actually has a very, very familiar ring to it. It's very similar to, for example, how the Chinuch is set up. At some point, we'll do the Hakdama to the Sefer Chinuch, which is a very, very fun Hakdama. But the Sefer HaChinuch is also set up in a way where it has, for instance, the source of a mitzvah, it'll have the tam of the mitzvah, and then it'll start getting into applications of the mitzvah, okay? For the most part, that's how the Sefer HaChinuch is set up. In a similar way, Rav Hirsch sets up Chorev. Okay, there's the chiyuv of the Jew, what the Jew's obligated in, the source in the Torah for that obligation, very similar to the chinuch. But then this is where he's different. Okay, he starts developing. He's very vague about this. We'll get to this later on. He tries to develop the nature of the idea of the obligation in a way that the average Jew, when he reads to it, will find it appealing. Meaning that there was a gap between the performance of mitzvah. And I'm going to say this carefully, not the reason for, but the rationale of the mitzvah. that gap that existed was something that was turning Jews off to following the Torah. So Rav Hirsch's goal is to go ahead and write a sefer where what's going to happen is he'll be able to describe the mitzvah in a way that people will say, oh, I see why this mitzvah really appeals to me, or why I would want to do such a mitzvah. And finally, he says you can also use Chorev for practical guidance from the Shulchan Aruch. Now, to be clear, as he's going to say later on, you can't paskin from Chorev. Chorev is not a sefer of halacha, but he opens up certain doors for you. So what Rav Hirsch will say is, when you read a certain section and you see like a basic guide of a halachic area, then go to the Shulchan Aruch for more specifics of what to do. But this is how he structures Chorev. We're not getting into the sections yet, but we're going to get to the basic structure. The Chiyuv, the source in the Torah for the Chiyuv, the nature and the idea of the Chiyuv, and finally, practical guidance, a good advice and direction for how best to take care of fulfilling this obligation. So why did he write it? Okay, why does he decide to write Chorev? What's the big deal? Okay, so he makes some very, very, in my opinion, very interesting observations about the period of time he lived in. So first he says, our century wants to think, and that is its greatest merit. So it sounds like he's someone who really supports the idea of intellectual discovery and curiosity. It's something that he would endorse, okay? Again, thinking is something that he holds is very, very important. But then he notices two trends. He says the older generation, okay, and again, I'm curious what's changed from the 1800s to today. The older generation, so they do the mitzvahs, okay? They do them. But they do it like in a robotic way. Because they lack any spirit whatsoever. They do it, you know why? Because they've been doing it, okay? It reminds me, I don't mean to say this in it's not meant in a condemning way. It's Baruch Hashem people do this, but it's like Minyan, right? It's like some people, they go to Minyan because they go to Minyan. Right, that's what they do. It's like part of their schedule. It's not like the Gemara says, "Vayifgab ha'makom," that Yaakov, he was like he was surprised when he came up to the place. But in Vayetze, there's a certain surprise, a spontaneity a person's supposed to have when they daven. But it happens to me that when people get older, you tend to do these things because it's part of your routine. Hirsch doesn't like that. Rav Hirsch does not like that at all. So he doesn't want robots. He says that's bad. So one trend is older people tend to do mitzvos because that's what they do. They keep Shabbos because they've always kept Shabbos. It's a little bit more than being a cultural Jew, but it just means like you've been trained a certain way and this is what you're used to doing. But where's the fire? Where's the passion? According to Hirsch, that doesn't exist by the older people. The younger generation, now they have enthusiasm. They they want to think. They're driven by desire to know and to understand. That sounds great. Okay, so why write Chorev for? But the problem is that because of this intense drive that the young people have to understand, they're not drawn towards authentic Judaism, meaning part of this enthusiasm they have is to go away from the mitzvos as they are and have Judaism evolve. So again, Hirsch's life is always about tensions. So he's putting himself right in the middle. On the one hand, you have older people who they're yotzei mitzvos, right? But the passion that's required is lacking. The younger generation, they because they're thinkers, they have this tremendous enthusiasm to really understand Judaism. But in trying to understand it, it's leading them away from adherence to the system of mitzvos as they are. And there's also an undercurrent in the way he describes this, almost as if to say there's a responsibility or a failure in the older generation to really impassion the younger generation to follow Judaism in such a way. Meaning, since the older generation is kind of like, just going through the motions, that clearly has an impact on the younger generation. And their rejection of the way the older generation is doing it leads them down this road. Okay, so here what Hirsch is saying is that we have to be aware there's a huge gap. There's a big gap between what one viewpoint, which is follow mitzvos without any spirit, as he puts it. And the other viewpoint is we're so into the ideology of Judaism, but not so much into the way the mitzvos are structured. We want to evolve. We want to move away from the way mitzvos has always been done and improve on it and make it better. Okay, so that's why he's writing Chorev. He's writing Chorev because he wants the younger generation to change. He's basically written off the older generation because he realizes that at the end of the day, okay, so they're doing the mitzvos. Do they know why, or they do it out of any passion? No, they do them. But in order for the system to sustain itself, it's more important that you have people follow mitzvos than what the younger generation are doing, because the younger generation are going to end up corrupting the mitzvos themselves. So the older generation, he's not addressing them whatsoever. They're stuck in their ways. Gesundheit, leave them alone. But when it comes to the younger people, what Hirsch wants to take upon himself is, how does he figure out a way to demonstrate to them, okay, meaning to the mitzvos, okay, relevance, okay? How is he going to do that? How is he going to demonstrate to young people how the Torah is true? Because it just doesn't come across to them that way. So that's a very, very, very difficult challenge that he's taken upon himself. But it's certainly in the spirits, okay, it's certainly in the spirits of some other great theologians we've seen over the centuries. Rav Sajikon responding to a problem, or Rav Yehuda Levi responding to a problem. Often, or the Sefer Ikarim, or Kreskes, or Mor Nevuchim, you name it, these Sfarim often are written as a response to a specific problem taking place. Hirsch is no different. Hirsch recognizes that there's a problem, the younger generation are wandering away, we need some way to inspire them and demonstrate to them how Torah is true, okay? And of course, Hirsch says in classic, quasi-humble fashion, he doesn't want to be the one to do this, but no one else has really stepped up to the plate to take on this responsibility. Okay. Now, Hirsch can be very harsh on people. Hirsch now moves to basically really slam the way people were learning Torah during his period of time. Now, this is an important thing, an important development, which is which I'll explain in a second. But basically, there's something called Pilpul. Now, Pilpul is a very, like I'd say, generic term. It refers to a certain style of learning Gemara that some would argue is hyper-intellectual. Briskers look at Pilpul and say that's too much. Briskers themselves could be accused of being underneath the umbrella of Pilpul. Certainly, what happens is that this focuses more on basically, like I'd say, intellectual gratification, understanding the construct of Gemara itself, and not as much as getting into like the core of what a mitzvah is. Okay, it's basically listening to. Imagine walking into a room and hearing two people learning Gemara discussing it like a Socratic dialogue. To Hirsch, that's terrible. That is just destroying the way Torah is meant to be studied. To him, it's lacking there's a gap between the way Gemara is being learned and the passion and enthusiasm a person is supposed to have towards halacha. So what does Pilpul do? It takes all the fun out of learning. Okay, it's like you'll see a Tosfos, and Tosfos will say hachanami, and you'll say, why do you see hachanami here, and et cetera, et cetera. He was very against this type of learning. To him, again, it was destructive to what Lima Torah is supposed to be like. So then, what's Chorah for then? So it's written for, just to quote him, it's written for all those who want to know what it means to be a Jew and what Judaism demands of them. That's a pretty, pretty large task he's putting on himself. All those who want to know what it means to be a Jew and what Judaism demands of them. In one volume, by the way, which is about that big. So it's clear he's shooting for the stars and trying to write a sefer like this. You'll see that, how he ends up trying to pull it off. But what's interesting is that Hirsch openly is rejecting. In other words, if you said to Hirsch, listen, why not read your Sefer? Let me read the Kuzari. I mean, the Kuzari is a defense of the Jewish faith, right? Let me read the Mor Nevuchim. Let me read Emunas Vedeos. No, he's saying for his time, right, this is the Sefer that Jews of Akli in his time need to read, okay? Which gets to an interesting question. What's the Sefer of our time? That really is the Chorev version. Do we really have a Sefer today that really accomplishes what a Sefer like Chorev or Emunas Vedeos or Kuzari, etc. sought out to achieve? I would say the answer is no. I do not think we have a major philosophical work of that caliber. Okay, so that's how he ends off his letter, okay? Which leads us now to the actual introduction to Chorev itself, okay? So, all right, so the first part of the introduction really, really focuses on another core issue that defines Hirsch's, I'd say, outlook when it comes to adherence to the mitzvos. And basically what he says is that the most important thing a person needs to do is follow the mitzvos. And why do you have to follow the mitzvos? Because it's God's will. Now, again, let's think about this for a second. He's telling us he's going to write a sefer that's going to demonstrate to us the appeal of mitzvos. He's going to write a sefer that talks to the Jew and gives them meaning. And yet the first thing he tells you, the first thing he says is that don't bother asking why you must do a mitzvah. You do a mitzvah because it's God's will, period. That's the reason why. Notice, by the way, he doesn't even mention anything about proving that Torah was given at Sinai or getting into proofs of God's existence. Nope. God's will. That applies to both Torah and rabbinical law, okay? And therefore, at this point, he's really attacking the benefit of Tamei Mitzvos. Now, Tamei Mitzvos refers to trying to understand the reason why we do a mitzvah. So, for instance, if you pick up the third section of the Mor Nevuchim, you'll see in the third section of the Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam's rationales for why we do mitzvahs, okay? And Hirsch is attacking that notion. Hirsch feels that Tamei Mitzvos is a very dangerous, very problematic avenue to ever take, because it's irrelevant why the mitzvah exists. We have to do it no matter what because God said so, all right? So who cares? Why do you have to know why you perform a commandment? What's the necessity of trying to understand why I must do this? It's God's will. That's all a person needs to know. Ultimately, God's will is the answer to everything. Now, of course, at this point, you'd say, so then why bother writing Chorev? Right? There's no need to write Chorev if that's what it comes down to. But he's very clear that this is his approach. And the reason why, okay, why should one follow a commandment? It's the will of God. Okay, and as he says, it is your duty to be the servant of God with all your power and resources and with every breath of your life. That's a person's entire objective, okay? What's the ideal Jew? He's a servant of God. He's the Eved Hashem, okay? And therefore, if a Jew never grasped the rationale for any mitzvah, okay, yet did all the mitzvahs, according to Hirsch, he'd be living the best possible life. So there's never a need to understand why you do a mitzvah. You just do it, right? As long as you do the mitzvah, you are in the best state of existence a human being could be in. And he emphasizes that over and over in the Hakdamah. This is a key point, that there's no necessity. There's no necessity whatsoever to ever understand the rationale for any mitzvah. Do it because God said so, okay? And I think we can all agree, this is not at all how the Rambam and many others would see success in Judaism. Many of the Rishonim would argue that it's imperative that a person have some rationale, some understanding of the reason for the mitzvah. It goes hand in hand with that. Now, as you'll see, Hirsch, and he does pivot a bit. He's not going to take this all the way, because if he did, he wouldn't have written Chorev. But he doesn't, and you can also sense his fear, or I should say his concern about this, does stem from the fact that what would happen, that people would speculate about reasons for mitzvos, which could lead them to not follow the mitzvah, or they could look at a mitzvah and they could say, this makes absolutely no sense. This is stupid. Unfortunately, I hear that often, since I do deal with younger people, that, agreed, right? I do this in younger people. Younger people say, I'm not doing that. That's a stupid mitzvah, right? Of course, I always ask them, have you researched it? Usually they haven't, but there's a fear that Hirsch has. That's what's going to end up happening if we go ahead and just, if we start researching and trying to understand the reason for a mitzvah. So he's trying to protect the system in using this approach. Okay. So. He says like this. He now says, okay, of course he values intellectual curiosity. He wants people to explore, okay? He absolutely wants people to explore. But here's the tricky part with Hirsch, okay? He just doesn't want people to make their performance of mitzvos conditional. That's something, again, my bias is on the table. I come across this quite often. It's a very common thing. My circles are modern Orthodox, so I don't recruit outside of modern Orthodoxy. But I come across often, more often than I expected, a young person who'll say, you know, it's not that, it's the opposite of Hirsch. It's not that God's will is for me to follow the Torah, therefore I do it. But now that I'm in the system, I'll go ahead and try to understand how it works. Rather, what I find is I get kids who say, why should I follow Judaism, right? If Judaism speaks to me the right way, then I'll follow it. They make it conditional, okay? He is as opposed as possible to the idea of a conditional performance, right? That's one of the biggest threats to Judaism. How you have someone say, listen, I'll do it if. There's no I'll do it if. I'm doing it. Now that I'm doing it, let's analyze certain things. But you cannot approach it, according to Hirsch, by ever making it a conditional performance, okay? So again, it's like someone says, I'll follow the mitzvos if they make sense. To Hirsch, that's an impossibility. Don't even bother. Okay. He says, rather, what should we do? We should be like our forefathers at Sinai and do Naaseh V'Nishma, right? Naaseh V'Nishma, which means that we'll follow the commandments prior to understanding the commandments. That's funny because that we're always taught that the traditional pshat is Naaseh V'Nishma means they said we're going to do the mitzvos, we'll adhere to them prior to actually understanding them, which certainly on a simple level is a raya, is a proof to what Hirsch is saying. However, it's interesting. The Ibn Ezra has a pshat where he wants to say, he doesn't like this idea. He says that they only said Naaseh V'Nishma because Amara, again, it's not open in the Torah, but Chazal bring down that Amara, which is prior to Sinai, so God introduced them to Shabbos and a few other halachas, dinim, whatever. Well, let's say whatever, 40 mitzvahs, okay? Point is, they got a taste of the system. Once they got a taste of the system, now they said, well, we see these 40 mitzvahs make sense. Naaseh V'Nishma. We don't need to see the rest of the system. So the Ibn Ezra held, and others agree with that approach, is that it wasn't Naaseh V'Nishma like, you're God, we're going to follow the mitzvos blindly. Rather, God gave them a few mitzvos. They checked them out. They did some research. They said, oh, we like this. This is very good stuff. The sample size is good enough for us to commit to the system in its entirety without seeing the rest of the system. So the Ibn Ezra would disagree with this. But according to Hirsch, we have to be the kind of people that basically say we accept the mitzvos prior to understanding them. If God said we have to do it, that should be the driving force for why we do the mitzvos. That's it. So again, this whole area is all about doing it because God said so. Okay. Now he shifts gears a little bit and he gets into why study Torah. Okay. Now, notice again, that kind of question seems to like almost contradict Hirsch's whole approach. His whole approach is we never ask the why. So he's not condemning why, condemning the why question. He just is trying to explain the benefit of it. In other words, of course a person's chayav to study Torah, but now that you accept that as a reality, let's understand why a person would study Torah. So he says the first reason a person studies Torah is to know all the commandments. Right? It's very simple. When you sit down to learn, right, let's say learn Gemara. Okay, you're there to learn all of the commandments. The goal is to get them all down, okay? Because there's no possible way you could ever serve God well without knowing all the commandments. So objective number one is to understand all the commandments, like literally like the Shulchan Aruch, okay? Just the list of what a person needs to do, okay? That's number one. The other reason is a little trickier, okay? He wants you to understand the relationship that exists between commandments, as an example. All right. He wants you to bring the commandments into human comprehension. He wants you to understand the consequences of not following the commandments. Now, this is again, bordering, I'd say, it's not strictly following a list. Rather, he's adding in other factors, which he's putting underneath this other umbrella of Torah study, which I'd say is secondary to the actual commandment itself. Okay. Again, it's interesting that he says, understand the consequences of not following the commandments. A person has to realize, for instance, the philosophical harm it brings to the soul. That if a person doesn't follow the Torah well, there's a harm there. A person has to understand that. And of course, seeing the wisdom of God in all the commandments. So this entire area here, all these things, you're not going to really find in a Shulchan Aruch or in a listing of like a manual of halacha. So one type of Torah study is the manualization of Torah. The other kind is, I'd say, the other various elements, relationships between the mitzvos, understanding the philosophical consequences, seeing the chokhmah of God. When you do this second one as well, then this second type of Torah study comes to, in a sense, I'd say, surround the first type of Torah study and then brings the mitzvos up to the level they're supposed to be on. So that's how they work hand in hand. The first one's definitely the ikker, because you cannot even talk about being an Eved Hashem without knowing the mitzvos. The second type of Torah study, I'd say, and I'm not trying to minimize it, but it's there really to take the mitzvos and give them what Briskers would say is like a tzura. It's to tighten the kesher between the person, the performer, and the mitzvah itself. It's all those additional factors that really, I'd say, take this very, very tempting cake and put the frosting and the candles and all the other elements that make the cake taste even better onto it, okay? But again, note, by the way, there's a very fine line between seeking out the reasons. Like, he's not saying why you should learn Torah. He's saying this is what learning Torah will result in. So a person has to know if he learns Torah, this is what he'll gain from that. Okay, so what's an example? Okay, so he says there are some commandments where the actual performance of the commandment itself, of the mitzvah, is tied to revealing, as he puts it, some train of thought. Okay, there's some train of thought that a person didn't know about, that through the mitzvah itself, he'll see that. He'll see how things work, like a certain like line of thinking, okay? Meaning that these type of mitzvahs, it's not sufficient to just do the action, but there's an analysis that's required, a person to think into it, okay? Like Shabbos and Shofar and Tzitzis. Shabbos is a good example. The Hirsch would never say that a person should just not do malacha on Shabbos. That's not keeping Shabbos, right? I mean, it's technically keeping Shabbos, but that's not what the function of Shabbos is. The function of Shabbos is to produce a certain state in the gavra, or let's say shofar. Okay, shofar. It's not just the mechanical. I heard a ram's horn being blown. I mean, I'm yotzei my mitzvah that way. But even Hirsch would have to agree that what does that do then? By listening to the shofar blast, it'll now lead me to think about certain ideas about tshuva. So there's the performance of the mitzvah leads you down a certain road. And I mean, again, it has to be the case. Again, it's not tamei mitzvah. Rather, it's the effect of the mitzvah. Or tzitzis. When a person's wearing tzitzis, what's the function of tzitzis? Ur isa moso uzuchartem. It's called mitzvah Hashem. When I see the tzitzis, okay, not just the strings, but the beged in its entirety, what happens? So then I will now recall all the mitzvahs. So there's a direct relationship between the performance and some, let's say, rationale, some benefit that emerges as a result that requires analysis. Okay, as well, one must study the various components of the commandment. It's not enough just to say, I have to look at tzitzis as one entity, but they have to understand how the mitzvah has parts to it. A great example, just going back to tzitzis, a great example is, if you ever look at the tzitzis strings, so you'll see that there's various components. There are the knots, okay, and then which is the gedilim. There's the anaf, which are the strings that hang down. There's the relationship of tchelis to lavan. All these things are different parts that together produce the chalo shema tzitzis. Each one has its own unique role. Together, there's a certain, ultimate role that comes about from them, okay? So this demands a certain level of reflection. So again, he's trying to elevate the performance from simply being robotic. He's trying to demonstrate where that passion comes from. Okay, but one second, okay? Didn't Rav Hirsch say all along that the reasons for the commandments are not something we should pursue? We should never be interested in tamei mitzvos? So he says, don't worry. He says, you can investigate how the mitzvah works, okay? And then you can derive meaning. This is as far as he's willing to go. You can derive some meaning from it. You can never ask, why should I do this? But a person does have the right. In other words, again, he wants there to be some creativity. So when I'm analyzing, let's say shofar, okay, and I'm listening to the shofar and it reminds me of tshuva, there is a point where a person can now inject his own subjective relevance of what's taking place here. As long as he follows that track of Corner Hirsch, it's okay for a person when he hears shofar, it doesn't have to follow that strict formula. He can be a little creative there, okay? But it all comes down to where the person starts from. If you start from the attitude of, why should I do this at all? You're done, according to Hirsch. But if you start from if your starting point is, I accept this as a mitzvah, I recognize there must be wisdom in the mitzvah, I will investigate the mitzvah to unleash and unlock that wisdom, you're going to do very, very well for yourself, okay? Again, buy into the system first, and then work out the intellectual benefits. It's not so easy. This is not such an easy thing for people to do, but this is what Hirsch's expectation is on Jews. Now, this leads him, this idea of the two ways of learning Torah, leads him to the next, what he calls like the two schools of learning. Okay, now they're not really two schools of thought, okay, in essence, but so you'll see there's two ways of learning Torah that now he's going to go ahead and also fuse together. So what are they? So the first focus is on practical law, things that you heard, okay? The adherents deal with, it deals with the comprehension of all the various mitzvahs, okay? And the purpose of learning then is geared to figuring out what the legal outcome is. So again, if I picked up a Gemara, and this is what he's going to say in a second, if I pick up a Gemara, what's the objective in Gemara? What's Gemara written for? Gemara is written for to produce a legal outcome. I need to know what to do, okay? That's what I have to do. And the conclusions are binding. So as we know, how did Gemara work? So a large chunk of Gemara is halacha. right? And according to Hirsch, right, once you have stimas hashas, once the Gemara is sealed with Ravina Ravashi, that's it, okay? So when a person, in Hirsch's mind, when a person learns Gemara, it's not brisker learning. According to Hirsch, learning Gemara has, I'd say, you'll see in a second, most of Gemara, the halachic stuff, has one objective, knowing what to do. That's why a person should sit down and read Gemara, to get to the point of what to do. All right? Now, of course, someone could argue, why not just learn Shulchan Aruch then? You can have that same result in Shulchan Aruch. I ask that to people quite often. If it's just practical law, there's a lot of Svarim that are written that are much easier to read. So it'll be the things heard is what he would say. Because in the Gemara, you actually are hearing the Mesorah, so to speak. Meaning, in other words, the Gemara itself contains our Mesorah in it. So when you're focusing on the practical law and getting to what we have to do, at least you're doing it in a way where you see the Mesorah in action. But ultimately, when the Gemara is sealed, when it comes to halacha, there is no room anymore for any type of innovation. On the other hand, though, there's another school of thinking, okay? And that's the school that's focused on reflecting and pondering, okay? This is where Hirsch allows for creativity to enter the picture. See, if we stop with the first school, we'd have a serious problem, because how are you going to entice and get young Jews to learn? If you're telling me it's basically just a list of rules, that's not the kind of thing that's going to make the younger generation really inspired to learn, to be religious. But the second way is, I think, where he thinks is the fire will be lit, because it's about reflecting and pondering, where creativity is more of a factor, okay? And that's what he refers to as agadata. So if I looked at Gemara, okay, and this is a critical point in Hirsch, when I look at Gemara, there's two things in there. There is the law, and that's static, okay? That ends with stimas hashas. So when a person learns Gemara, his goal should be to get to the practical outcome, and that's it. And when it comes to the creative part of your mind, according to Hirsch, you shut that off. But agadata, that's ripe for the picking. That is there for creative thinking. And that's not bound by stimas hashas, okay? The idea of agadata, this concept of speculation, like, for instance, what Hirsch will do in his commentary on Chumash. I'm not saying it in a bad way. This idea of creative speculation, there are areas for creativity, okay? He looks at agadata as a way to think. Right, there are areas where a person can apply his creativity. You want to read a Chumash Pshat, Chumash all the way. Agadas in the Gemara, Medrash, Tehillim, whatever you want. There's plenty of areas where a person's capable of really using their creativity. Okay, and there's nothing binding that emerges from it. When you learn an Agadita, okay, when you learn a Parish and Chumash, what's great? One of the great things about it, one of the I'd say freer things about it, is it's not a binding idea, right? I can come up Pshat and Chumash, and someone else will come up Pshat and Chumash. It could be completely different than mine. So what? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter insofar as law is concerned. So Hirsch sets up in a very neat way, really two different kinds of learning. There's the static learning halacha type, right? Which is, again, divorced from real, I'd say any real creativity. I'm saying that carefully. I don't mean responsa. But I mean just like the manualization of halacha. And the other kind is the creative type. That's what he calls agadita. And agadita lends itself to curiosity, to exploration. And because it's not binding, that's why it's not dangerous. So what he doesn't want the creative thinking to work its way into the legal system. That's what he doesn't want. He doesn't want that. So now he brings the two systems together, okay? We know we have a set of laws that are binding. Okay, and we also know we're able to offer speculative insights into certain areas of Torah. So we start off with the mitzvos. Okay, the mitzvos are the anchor. Okay, they're the foundation. Okay, and then we can use that to get into agadata itself. Meaning you can't speculate before the system of law is concretized. First, the system of law is set up as the foundation, and then once you have that in place, knock yourself out by speculating away. Okay, but you must have that the system of law grounded as firmly as possible before you explore agadata. So agadata in many ways, not to be too Aristotelian, but agadata in many ways is the result. It's causally dependent on the law. The law comes first, which is consistent with how Hirsch looks at things. Okay, so now as we get closer to the end of the Hakdama, now he gets into how, in a more specific way, how Chorev is constructed, okay? Remember, we saw before in the letter his overview, which is the chiyuv, the source of the chiyuv, some nice ideas that make the chiyuv more appealing, and then ultimately some practical guidance, now comes some more specifics. So first he says, both the law, okay, meaning the mitzvah, and a perush are presented. Now, he's not trying to replace the Shulchan Aruch. That's not his objective here, because the Shulchan Aruch, and again, I don't mean this in a bad way, but Shulchan Aruch is a dry sefer. It's not there to offer interpretations, okay? So what Hirsch wants to do is he presents the halakhas in Chorev in a very general way, because what he'll do is it's like opening up the door. As the Rambam would say, it's Roshei Prakim. It's like the chapter headings. It's like the first baby steps into understanding the halakhic system. So once you read the general halakha as he presents it, so then what's going to happen is you're going to want to go investigate it further. And that's why the purpose here is to prepare the reader for the performance of the law in actual life. Okay, so they're introduced with these unique ideas that he's come up with in order to enhance the performance of the mitzvah itself. But what he emphasizes is that whatever ideas are introduced, don't ever, God forbid, chas v'chalila, ever think that any idea he comes up with can reflect any change on the mitzvah itself. So again, it's beautiful how he writes. There's the law, and the gadata emerges from it. He's proving it in how he, but he's taking that approach and plugging it into Chorev. The law comes first. The ideas are very nice. You can use, through the lens of the law, you can come up with creative concepts of the you know, mitzvah A, B, C. But you can never say, ever, that any idea you come up with, no matter how profound, can somehow change what the law is. Okay? So, who does he look to? He basically relies on the Shulchan Aruch primarily as a source of halacha, and the Be'er Heitev, who's a summary of the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so those are his two sources that he relies on when he brings in his various halachas in Chorev. But of course, as he says, he puts his own opinion throughout the Sefer. He emphasizes that he's using that creative methodology of a Gadatza to get to his conclusions, but he doesn't want you to think that his approaches, his views, are just fantasy, meaning it's not just like free association. Rather, he has a methodology. There's a methodology that he says you can trace from the mitzvah to his creative solution. There is a methodology there. There is something, there's some track you could find. But he acknowledges that he could be wrong. So while he thinks he's following this, or he's saying he's following this methodology, he's also acknowledging that there's no way to demonstrate with 100% certainty that the various ideas he's presenting for his mitzvos are actually correct. Okay, so now he actually lists the various sections, which what I put on this part here is what he actually writes before each section as what each section is about. Okay, and I'll explain a little bit in a second. So the first section is called Toros. Okay, Toros are the fundamental principles related to mental and spiritual preparation for life. Now, if he were the Rambam, this would be philosophy. This would be proofs of the existence of God. This would be why I should believe in God. He doesn't have that in Toros. Toros rather is right in the beginning. He gets into what he called you believe in God. That's the given. Now the question is how you should see that belief in God, Avas Hashem, things like that. How to develop that relationship. That's all in Toros, and that gets you ready for how you're supposed to live your life. Eidos, symbolic observances representing truths which form the base of Israel's life. Or, in other words, what is that referring to? That's referring to the Chagim, for example, or Shabbos, okay? He wants to take Shabbos from the realm of the symbolic, right, and demonstrate what's true about it. So he spends time going through, as an example, Chagim, and showing how, like, the idea of picking up a lulav, what concept is derived from picking up a lulav, as an example. Mishpatim, okay, declarations of justice towards human beings, which basically means proper social behavior. Ben Adam Lechavero, that's the section of Mishpatim. Now, Chukim, this is what he writes, laws of righteousness towards those beings which are subordinate to man, towards earth, plant, animal, towards one's own body, mind, spirit, and word, okay? So it's interesting, he has a whole section on this kind of stuff, on mitzvos, for instance, let's say, Truma, agricultural, etc., how you have to treat your own body. That's all in the section of Chukim, a very different way of looking at what Chukim are. Usually Chukim are, in classic commentaries, Chukim are commandments we don't understand. That's how Hirsch learns Chukim in this instance. Mitzvos are commandments of love. An example would be honoring your parents. And finally, he has Avoda, divine service, which includes things like Tefillah. He has a beautiful section on Tefillah. And that's in the last section of Avoda. So these are the various sections. Toros, Eidos, Mishpatim, Chukim, Mitzvos, and Avoda. That's what it called, Chorev is comprised of. Those are these sections. Okay. So as we get to the end of the Hakdama, he says, and he's adamant about this, he is not here to defend anything. Okay? That's what a Kuzari does. That's what a Sajagon does. That's what a Kreskus does. He is not interested in defending, he's not here to defend the mitzvos. That's not his job. He's not a defense attorney. Okay? Once you acknowledge that there's a need to defend the mitzvos, then according to Hirsch, you're opening up the door to even suggest somehow that the mitzvos aren't divine. My premise must be, he can't let go of this point, my premise has to be that the mitzvos are from God. So therefore, I must express complete obedience, complete belief in the system of mitzvos first, before I even engage in understanding the chorev or any mitzvah. In other words, I must first have that idea in place. I must believe in God and that his will is for me to follow the Torah, and then I can start pursuing this information. But I can never, ever dwell on the why. It's always about the what and the how, and never about the why. And he says, if you're looking for any kind of defense, don't read this book. This book is not for anybody looking for a defense of Judaism. He doesn't feel that's his responsibility, because again, once he has to defend it, then what he's ultimately saying is that it's possible that the mitzvos are not divine in origin. And like I said before, clearly the fact he doesn't feel like there's a necessity to do this is a slap in the face to thinkers like Sajagon and Rav Yehuda Levi. Now, granted, in his period of time, there was already a belief, the philosophy had really shifted dramatically, and there was a belief that, beginnings of the belief, that maybe philosophy itself was, that philosophy could never do a good job defending Judaism, and you could definitely make a compelling argument that's why he acknowledges this. I'm not sure if everyone would agree with that, but I think it's certainly what Hirsch believed. Hirsch believed at this point that using proofs of God is senseless. So that leads us off finally, where it's very funny how he advertises himself at the end. So who is this book for? So if you're somebody, this is obviously my paraphrasing, but are you somebody who attaches value to the mitzvos initially, right? Are you someone who feels their only mission in life is to serve God? Are you someone with an quote-unquote urgent need to familiarize yourself with the commandments as a whole? Are you someone who wants to gain meaning from the commandments, okay? Are you someone who doesn't mind a little bit of rebuke, which Hirsch does every so often in Chorev? If you are all those things, then Chorev could definitely be the right book for you. So think about this before picking up the Sefer. It's amazing the expectations he has in picking up the Sefer. He's not looking for, and again, from my experience, I usually recommend Chorev to guys who aren't looking, rightly so, who aren't looking for a proof of God or why they should do this. Rather, people who already have their feet in the system, right? They believe in Judaism. They're just looking for something more. They need like an oomph. So Hirsch, in many ways, provides, in my opinion, that intellectual oomph to get somebody who's already in it to that next level. Okay, he's not there for somebody who is looking for arguments for the existence of God or free will, things of that nature. Hirsch won't touch that with a 10-foot pole. So that's Hirsch's introduction to Chorev. I hope everyone learned a little bit about his philosophy, which is a very, I'd say, refreshing and unique philosophy. I definitely recommend Chorev. It's a tremendous sefer. It really is great insights into mitzvos. Hirsch's, it's a monumental work that really should be on the right next to everyone. It should be in everyone's bookcase, right next to their Shmir Shabbos Lechasa and their Mishnah Berurah. Chorev should be right next to them. All right, enjoy the rest of your week.